by Kaplan, and
is it okay if I don't use the mic?
Yes.
I didn't come to give you a lecture, that's the truth. I'm a chaplain with York Regional Police, and an officer told me that he once pulled somebody over in the 407 at 3:30 in the morning or so. The guy was going about 40 kilometers over the speed limit. He said to him, "Where are you rushing at 3:30 in the morning?" He said, "To a lecture." He said, "Who's going to give you a lecture at 3:30 in the morning?" He says, "My wife." So I'm not here to give you a lecture. I'm not going to use the mic. In fact, I'm just wondering if there's a reason everybody's sitting behind a chair. Do you feel threatened? You okay if I sit and just like spend some time together? L'chaim, everybody. L'chaim. I want to thank my friend Reb Mordechai for his warm words. I wish my mother was here to hear it. She actually would have believed everything he said. And we do have a special friendship, though, and it's an honor and a privilege to get together often and to learn Torah together. And when Jewish people come together to learn Torah, I think it's not only a meeting of the minds, there's a meeting of the heart, there's a meeting of the soul, and wonderful things happen. Like this. So l'chaim, everybody. L'chaim. Is there something specific that somebody in this room wants to talk about?
How did you get the door fixed so fast?
How did we get the door fixed? I have to tell you the truth. I have a very able chief of operations. His name is Rabbi Yossi, and he was on top of it. That's the answer.
We didn't catch the man, no.
No. You've seen the videos? People saw the video?
Yeah.
Very disconcerting. Mm-hmm. Very disconcerting. So, if that's going to be our point of departure, on the night of the Seder, there's this little piece that people are very familiar with. Most people sing it. There's different tunes. You know what I'm talking about? Yehisha Amda? Vishamda Lavoteinu Volano. This is what has stood for us and for our fathers. Vishamda Vihi literally means the promise, because we talk about a promise. Baruch Shomer Haftachato. We talk about God who keeps his promise, keeps his word. And then we say Vihi, and that very word, that promise is what has kept us. And B'chol Dor V'Dor, we say, in every generation, they rise up against us and they want to destroy us. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but Almighty God, saves us from their hands. And that's what I was thinking about, actually, when I viewed this damage, and then the CP24 was interviewing me, and I was thinking, what do I want to say? And Vihishamd is what came to mind. So let me ask you a question, just as like a kind of a segue thing. Why would we be talking about the fact that there are people who try to destroy us in every generation on the night of Pesach? What does it have to do with the Seder night? Let's back up for a moment here. On the Seder night, it's an important night. Yes, everybody would agree?
Yeah.
Is anybody in this room who doesn't know why it's important or why it should be important? Yes? No? Please be honest. You don't know why it should be important. Thank you for your honesty. What is important to you, if I may ask?
Friendship, bond, help, peace, honesty.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all good virtues. Do you think that those virtues have something to do with us being a good Jewish people?
Yes.
I will agree. And I will tell you that without a Seder night and without the gift of Passover, we wouldn't be here as a nation. The most observed detail of Judaism, and there are many details in Judaism, the 613 mitzvot and many, many details, but the most observed Jewish ritual, bar none, including Kol Nidre night, is not synagogue-based, it's not high holiday-based, it's the Pesach Seder. There's like astronomical numbers that approach, in most parts of the world where Jewish people live, approach 90% of people that are having some kind of Seder. I'm not saying they're doing the Seder right, but they're having some kind of Seder because there's something about this night that is magical, enchanting, exhilarating, inspirational. people may not be able to articulate what it is exactly about this night, but somehow they're drawn to this night. So if being Jewish is important, and if the existence of a Jewish people is important, then the Pesach Seder has to be important. And without a Pesach Seder, we would not be. I'm oftentimes asked to produce archaeological evidence for the Exodus. And I ask, what would you like me to find? The Reeboks that Moses wore when he climbed the mountain? What kind of archaeological evidence would you expect to find 33 centuries later? The remnants of the manna? What could you find? So there is actually a movie called Patterns of Evidence, and it's a good movie to watch before Pesach. It's a Christian fellow who goes on this journey, and he discovers an enormous amount of archaeological evidence to there having been some kind of people and some kind of major event that causes a collapse of ancient Egypt as it had been known, and it results in a new ruling class, a new order, a new anthropology, really, in that whole region. So there is, like, even archaeological proof. But let me put it this way. For 3,300 years, every single year, on an annual basis, parents and children and grandchildren sat around the same table and talked about the Exodus. And they told the story. And they didn't just tell the story. It wasn't a monologue. The Torah says, "V'higadot olavimcha." You should tell your children. And telling your children really means that your children are supposed to ask, because elsewhere the Torah says, "Ki yisholcha vincha." There is a minority opinion by Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh, who says that if you didn't get the children to ask, you're not even fulfilling the mitzvah biblically. You're going through the motions. You're fulfilling the mitzvah by rabbinic ordination. But if you want to fulfill the mitzvah right, the children have to ask the question. And after they ask questions, then we can respond. Let me ask you, why is that important? Why is it important for the children to ask before we respond? Why would we have this opinion that the only way we can have a real educational experience on the night of Pesach is if the children ask and then we respond?
It shows interest.
It's even more than showing interest. It shows and breeds and nurtures engagement. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's a monologue. So I'm asking you to ask me questions, but I'm not being very successful today. Hopefully, you'll be more successful on your Pesach Seder. And precisely because there's a discomfort, and we have to break the ice, even though I don't know most of you, so I look scary, I'm just sitting far away. But if you're sitting around the table and you know each other, and it's parents and children and grandchildren and extended guests and visitors, so probably there's a familiarity or a certain commonality amongst people. It's not that hard for people to open up. In case it is, you had a cup of wine to drink right in the beginning. That was helpful. Yeah, started off with Kiddush, right? And then we start doing funny things. We do strange things. And we do the strange things pointedly. What are we trying to accomplish?
Tradition.
Huh?
Tradition.
Yeah, why do we do strange traditions? I mean, I know our traditions are strange to most people, but we do unusual things on this night. What are we trying to accomplish by doing unusual things?
We want people to ask questions.
We want them to ask questions. We try to provoke, we try to pique their curiosity. We don't do ridiculous things. It's a very carefully choreographed tradition. You know, like a couple of years ago, I was in New York before Pesach, and I bought a new hat. They don't really sell these hats in Toronto, at least not nice ones. So I get a hat in New York usually, and I didn't have room to carry home the hat box because I was carrying home a matzah box or two. So I decided I'm just going to wear two hats. And I show up at customs, and the guy looks at me, and he says, "You must be really smart." I go, "Thanks, but why do you say that?" He says, "I don't know. Everybody else wears one hat, and you're wearing two hats." And I did notice a lot of strange stares after that. A lot of people looking at me like something was wrong with me. So I thought to myself, why don't we just wear two hats at the Seder? And then all the kids will say, "Hey, Dad, why are we wearing two hats?" But we don't just do ridiculous things. We do things which have a basis in tradition, a basis in halacha, in the rules that we try to govern our lives by. But we do these things in an unusual way because we want to engage the children. We want them to ask. Yes, I know the children go to school and they learn the questions and they're kind of reading lines. But then again, in most school plays, the kids learn the lines. And they're still involved. You know that story of the little boy who came home and told his mother excitedly that he had gotten a part in the school play? And the mother said, "What part did you get?" He said, "I'm going to be the husband." And the mother said, "I thought you were going to get a speaking part." Even if you have to learn the lines, Even if you have to parrot over somebody else's question, you still ask the question. It creates a dialogue around the table. That's what real education is. A monologue doesn't change lives. Dialogues do. You know, there was a guy named Howard Gardner who published a groundbreaking book in 1983 about different kinds of intelligence. Familiar? Anybody hear about Howard Gardner? No? He's very big in the ECU world. But really, his writings are very compelling, although there are those who maintain that there's absolutely no anecdotal evidence to anything that he's saying, and it's just nice fairy tales. Nice ideas, but there's no proof that people actually process information differently. But what he's saying makes a good deal of sense. He says some people are very intelligent when it comes to visuals. They learn by observing things. They're able to keenly zero in on things. They see things, and that's how they learn. He says other people learn through music. They retain tunes. Tunes somehow talk to them, speaks to them, it gets them to react. They're able to be creative, they can compose music. I don't know that Bach or Beethoven were necessarily brilliant when it came to the stock market. They were certainly brilliant when it came to composing music. That was their genius, that was what they had brilliance. There are people who have a way with words, even though they don't have that much to say. But because they have a way with words, it sounds profound and interesting. And that's the way they convey messages, it's the way they learn. There are those who learn not so much through words, but through critical analysis and mathematical calculation, just very analytical, clear thinkers. There are people who are able to learn because they engage, they relate to other people. And because they relate and engage with people, that's how they learn. And then there are people who learn best intrapersonally, by self-respect, introspecting, by meditating on things and contemplating things. They don't do well in crowds. They don't necessarily learn as well from other people. But when they hear something and they think about it afterwards, and they ruminate on it, they're able to reach like a higher level of understanding or comprehension. This makes sense, doesn't it? There is no anecdotal evidence to prove any of this. He never did a case study, but it just makes good sense. Do you know that Howard Gardner's ideas are actually 3,000 years old? Think about the Seder night. There are songs that we sing on the Seder night that are unique to Passover, a lot of songs. In fact, there's probably no other night of the year that we do as much singing, from the beginning till the end. The liturgy of the Haggadah is very specific, very unique. It tends to have a traditional lilt to it, depending on what family you're from or where your family would have been for a few hundred years. The Haggadah sounds a certain way. Does that sound right?
Yeah.
And you hear the tune, and you remember your Zaidi, mm-hmm. and you remember something of your childhood, and it just somehow touches you in a certain way. The Haggadah is a story. Howard Gardner talks about storytelling, role-playing, storytelling. We do tell a story. In fact, that's what we're supposed to do this night. We're supposed to tell the story of the Exodus. And in many communities, the people who are telling the story will actually role play. My Zaidi used to run outside the house and put matzah on his back. It was a Galiziana minig from southern Poland. And he would knock on the door. And says, I heard this from my mother. And she would run to the door. Who is there? And he would say, Ayid fin Mitzrayim. A Jew is coming from Egypt. And they'd open the door and he'd walk in with matzah on his back. It's a whole like play. Some people are hiding the Afikoman, some people are looking for the Afikoman, some people wonder what the Afikoman is. There's like there's a lot of things going on. And there's a lot of logic in the Haggadah. The Haggadah makes logical statements. Not everything is a story. Some of these things are actually compelling ideas. And in the Haggadah there's introspection, like the Mishnah says, Bechol Dor v'dor, in every generation, Chayiv Adam Lirot et Atzmo. We have to see ourselves as going out of Egypt. And what that means is a really good question. But that's what you're supposed to do. See yourself. How do you see yourself? That's talking about introspection. It's talking about to stop and think for a moment about the reality of the world that's changing around me. And I have to see myself as if I have experienced some kind of personal exodus. If in some way I have left somewhere or I'm going somewhere. That the exodus is not just history, but it's dynamic. That's a very personal thing. And at the same time, it's interpersonal because there's dialogue. Do you know that if there's no children at the table, somebody is supposed to volunteer and ask the manashtana? Did you know that? Like somebody's supposed to be the child? Do you know that if a husband and wife are sitting at the table, they're supposed to ask, one should ask and one should answer? Because it's got to be a dialogue. It can't be a monologue. The Seder night is the most brilliant educational composition anywhere in world anthropology. You will never find a more profound, a more brilliantly constructed evening than the Seder night. And the Seder night has touched Jewish hearts and souls for literally 33 centuries. It wasn't possible for somebody not to have a Seder. Who didn't have a Seder? In Auschwitz, they had a Seder. Regardless of where we were and when we were, we had a Seder. So you want archaeological proof? What are the statistical chances that Jews living in North Africa and Jews living in Northern Europe, that Jews who lived across Asia and in India, all were telling the same story on the same night in the same way, doing the same things? There's a Haggadah from the Jews of China. It's printed. You can find it today. It's called the Kaifeng Haggadah. It's exactly like our Haggadah with one tiny difference. Their version of Kiddush follows the opinion of Bet Shammai, not Bet Hillel, which just dates them. It means that they arrived in China about 50 years after the destruction of the temple rather than 100 years, because 100 years later, everybody had resolved this to yet, and they still had the old version. By the way, right across the street in the Ram, there's a Siddur from Kaifeng too. You can go see it. Yeah, it's intuitively to the page. It's fascinating. It's with Chinese brushstrokes. And it's open to the page. Umepnei chata'enu galino me'artzenu. Because of our sins, we were exiled from our land. I'm sure the curator of the Ram doesn't know what he opened the page.
Accent.
Yeah. No accents, but it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. So the Jews in China had a Seder that's almost exactly the way we have a Seder. With one difference. We do Yak Nahaz, Yayin, Kiddush, Neir, Havdalah, Zman, so they did the Havdalah and the Zman a little different. That's the only difference. Slight variations. This paragraph's inserted this way, this word is tweaked here, or perhaps missing there. It's the same Haggadah. It's the same Seder. It's the same order. All this, the tunes are different, but the words to the songs are the same. You want archaeological proof? It is statistically impossible to have Jewish people who are incommunicado, some of them for 2,000 years, all to have somehow, fortuitously, managed to get the same text, to get the same ideas, to get the same system, the same order, on the same night of the year, doing this consistently, year after year after year after year. That really, on a scientific level, is the most compelling proof to the veracity, the truth, and the authenticity of Torah and of Yiddishkeit. So, if Yiddishkeit's important, if it's important that there should be a Jewish people, and I think it is, I will tell you that there is no greater night for us, no better opportunity for us, any time in the year, than the night of Pesach. And it's really, I said the word opportunity pointedly, because it's a chance for us to realize and recognize our potential in a way that's perhaps unparalleled all year long. Many people think that the center of Judaism is the synagogue, and they are wrong. They're wrong. This is the influence of other faith systems in whose midst we live. The center of Judaism is not the synagogue. The center of Judaism was, is, and will always be the Jewish home. With fancy synagogues, we have no tomorrow. With a Jewish home, there is eternity. The most important people in Judaism are not the fathers or even the mothers. When it came to the giving of the Torah, which we celebrate a short 7 weeks after the Exodus, after leaving Mitzrayim, and you should know that the giving of the Torah and leaving Mitzrayim are not mutually exclusive. In fact, Shavuot, which celebrates the anniversary of giving of the Torah, is not celebrated on a day of its own. You know which day you celebrate Shavuot? You celebrate Shavuot exactly 7 weeks after Pesach. That's the day. And we have a calendar that doesn't change. So in our calendar, Nisan always has its 30 days, Iyar always has its 29 days, so we have it always on the same day. It turns out that Shavuot is always on the sixth day of Sivan. But in times of the Talmud, when Nisan could have had 29 days, or Iyar could have had 29 days, we could have had Shavuot on the seventh day of Sivan, or it could have been on the fifth day of Sivan. And in fact, that was the case very often. Because Shavuot doesn't have a date. We don't celebrate the giving of the Torah on the day God gave the Torah. We celebrate the giving of the Torah 7 weeks after we left Egypt. Because let me tell you something interesting. How many of you saw Charlton Heston's movie, Ten Commandments? Yeah? You think it was like that?
No.
I read the book. It's not really. How many saw The Prince of Egypt?
Yeah.
I never know why he's called The Prince of Egypt. I would call it The Prince of Israel, but. Like the most famous line of Charlton Heston is, "Let my people go. Let my people go free." It's about freedom, right? But he never says that. That's the problem. If you read the book, it never says, let my people go free. He says, Shalach ami v'ya'avduni. He says, send my people forth, says God, and they will serve me. In other words, the essence of Yitzhiyah Mimitzrayim, of Exodus, is being able to throw off the shackles of a human taskmaster. We no longer serve the Pharaoh, we will be serving God. We become not servants of a human being, or a king, or a civilization. We become servants of God who is eternal. So the whole Shavuot, the whole idea of receiving the Torah, the whole notion of us being able to live by its light and by its inspiration, that is the essence of Pesach. That is the essence of the education that we give our children. This is the guidance, the focus that we try to impart. So, if you ask me, the most important person, the most important part of the Jewish population, look at the Medrash. The Medrash says God wants to give the Torah to the Jewish people. He said, who's the guarantor? How do I know you keep this? You know, like when you want a loan? The bank says, yeah, surety? You say, sure. And you go, what? I once saw a cartoon of a guy who went in for a loan. And in the cartoon, the guy's on his knees. And the banker says, please get up. Have a seat. He says, I'm quite comfortable on my knees. Can I have the loan? The banker says, you have surety? Either you're going to put up collateral. If you can't put up collateral, what can you get? Need somebody to sign for you. Somebody who's capable. If somebody who can pay the bill signs for you, no problem, you got your loan. So God says to the Jewish people, who's surety? You have collateral? Who guarantees me that your people are always going to remain committed and interested? So we said, we have great prophets. God said, not impressed. He said, we have great rabbis and rebbetzins. Not impressed. We have great ancestry. That's nice. Ancestry.com is a beautiful thing. It doesn't guarantee the future. Do you know which argument we made that actually worked? We said, Boneinu Areivim Badeinu. We said, our children will be the guarantors for us. And when we said, the children will guarantee, God says, now you can get the Torah. Because without children, there is no Judaism. Without children, there is no future. Without children, there is no tomorrow. So the most important members of the Jewish nation are not the rabbis, not even the rebbetzins, but the children. Who's the second most important people in the Jewish nation? When it comes to actually giving the Torah, God says to Moses that he should speak. And then he says he should talk or tell. And it's like redundant. Kotomar lebeit Yaakov v'tageid levnei Yisrael. This is what you should say to the house of Jacob. This is what you should be talking about to the sons of Israel. So the Medrash tells us, Rashi quotes us as the most literal way to understand this. He says, Kotomar means speak to the women, speak softly. Then you can talk to the men, and you can talk tough. Devarim HaKashim Kegidin. In other words, in order for us, meaning the Jewish people, to be successful at receiving the Torah, to be successful at maintaining, and about they being able to exist, to continue to exist, to outlive, to outwit, to outfox, to survive, and to triumph, who is God giving the Torah to first? Like whose buy-in did he need? The Jewish woman. And by the way, nothing has changed in 3,300 years. The second most important people of the Jewish people are the Jewish women. Pesach, most important night. Who's the focus on? Focus on the children. Where does the Pesach Seder take place? It takes place in the home. Who sets the tone of the home? Who is the one who creates the environment in the home? Who ensures that a Seder should look like a Seder, if not the mother, if not the woman of the home? And then the father gets to come and play his role, read his lines, look interested and engaged, try to get a good night's sleep so he doesn't fall asleep at the table. That's kind of like the cherry on the top. The Zohar tells us that if you eat matzah on the night of Pesach, your faith is miraculously fortified all year long. You know what the Zohar calls matzah? I heard some people say matzah is called the food of let my people go. Because it does interesting things to your digestive system. That's not what the Zohar says. The Zohar says it's called michla de mehemenuta. The Zohar says it's called bread of faith. Do you know why it's called bread of faith? Because it actually nurtures and fortifies our faith. So, I just wanted to share a few words about the Pesach Seder and why I think it's really important that you all utilize this night. I want to remind each and every one of you that these things that we do on Passover, on Pesach night, are only meaningful if we do them on Pesach. If you eat matzah and maror and drink wine sitting next to the Hanukkah menorah, you may have a nice Hanukkah evening, but you did not have a Pesach. If you do this on Rosh Hashanah, well, it's cute, but it's still not Pesach. If you want the benefit of Passover, there's a certain magic that's available. If you want that, you have to do it on Pesach night. That doesn't mean at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It doesn't mean at 7 o'clock in the afternoon. In Toronto, nightfall is 8:12 p.m. You can't do it before. It just doesn't work. And I know the kids are tired. This is why they're going to remember tonight. Because tonight's the night they get to stay up. I know there could be some older people. Put them to bed. Get them a nap. The way to do this right is on the night of Pesach. And if we utilize that Leil Shimurim, that magical, spiritual, enchanted night, as it should be, then we have a real hope and a real aspiration. And we can almost see that with God's help, we will not only be talking about the redemption, the miracles, and the wonders of yesteryear, but in fact, Be'ezrat Hashem, will together hopefully be toasting each other and saying L'chaim in the third Beis HaMikdash, in our eternal capital in Yerushalayim, and Heira will be Ameinu Amen.
Amen.
You have any questions? Questions to answer? I'm not saying I have answers, but you can have questions.
So I'm just wondering in terms of celebrating two nights.
Yeah.
So why do we still do that when we know the calendar?
This is an excellent question. I think maybe we should preface to explain to everybody why we do two nights to begin with. And then we'll have your question.
Sure.
What's your name?
Mayor.
Mayor has a question. Mayor's question is, why do we still do two nights? But I'm thinking that before I answer Mayor's question, why do we still do two nights, I probably should answer the question as why we do two nights altogether. The Torah doesn't... So let me just give you a short answer, Mayor. And after I give you a short answer, then I'll try to explain it.
Okay.
In modern terminology, in Israel, it takes 24 hours to get the download. Outside of Israel, it takes 48 hours. Now, how does that work?
Yeah.
So the Torah actually talks about one day of Pesach, one day of Yom Tov, and one Seder. That's what the Torah says. The calendar was supposed to be dynamic. I mean, somebody, one of the members of the Jewish people, and some other member of the Jewish people, are actually supposed to see the moon reappear. The moon does not go anywhere. The moon is always exactly where it was supposed to be. To the best of our knowledge, the moon has not gone anywhere in a very, very long time. At least 5,777 years, the moon is exactly where it is, and it hasn't gone anywhere. And we have no knowledge of it necessarily going anywhere anytime soon, unless you read those crazy things on Facebook about the moon exploding or something. So if the moon is in its place, what do we mean when we say the moon is reborn? So if you understand a little bit of the astronomical movements of the heavenly bodies, basically the moon is making this big orbit around planet Earth, but the moon is also making mini orbits. So because the moon is making mini orbits, in making its big orbit, that mini orbit goes for 29 days, 12 hours, and a bit. A certain amount of what the Rambam calls chalakim. The Rambam divides every single hour into 1,084 compartments or sections, because it's that way works according to the calendar. You can mathematically divide that number at infinitum. So we have a 29-day lunar cycle. What's the problem with a 29-and-a-half-day lunar cycle? There is an inherent problem with it. What is the problem?
Leap year.
Now, the problem is that we on planet Earth have days that are made up of days and nights. The sun rises, the sun sets, the sun rises, the sun sets. I'm not talking about the song of Fiddler on the Roof, but sunrise, sunset is a fact of life. So sunrise, sunset, and how long is that? It's 24 hours. And to the best of our knowledge, it's been 24 hours for a very long time. Okay, so 24 hours means that if you're going to have a month, how long should your month be? You say 30 days? Let's go with your working assumption of a month and 30 days. Let me ask you a question. If the lunar calendar, I mean the lunar cycle, is going to last exactly 29.5 days, so you had a month and your month was 30 days, now the moon has already begun its cycle almost 12 hours into your new month. Another month goes by, you have another 30-day month, now you're a full day behind. So your moon is going to be reborn now on the 29th day. It's going to reappear. After another 2 months, your moon is showing up on the 28th day of the month. Do you understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You no longer have a lunar calendar. Now you have a calendar, it's all over the place. And that's where the idea of a blue moon comes from. By the way, there is no such thing as a blue moon, even though there was one last month. Once in a blue moon means that the moon shows up twice in the Gregorian calendar in the same month, in the same 30 days, because it's actually only 29 and a half days. And it's very rare. That's why they say, like, oh, yeah, once in a blue moon. But it's just a euphemism. There is such a thing called a blood moon, a red moon. There is no such thing as a blue moon. The blue moon is a euphemism. But that can happen in the Gregorian calendar, because the Gregorian calendar is a seasonal or solar calendar. So in a solar calendar, we don't really care what the moon is doing. Supposedly the werewolves care, but regular people don't care. And the moon can show up at any given time, middle of the month, end of the month. It doesn't tell us anything. But God came along and said, before we're going to leave Egypt, he said, I want you to have a lunar calendar. In fact, it's the first mitzvah we get. HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim. God says, the first mitzvah you get is the ability to sanctify time, which actually speaks volumes. We are not supposed to be controlled by time. We're supposed to control time. People say, I couldn't get it done. Why not? I was overwhelmed. Time. I didn't have enough time. You make time. Trust me. Yesterday, when the doors of my show were shattered, I had a whole day scheduled before that happened. But at 9:38, when this started to happen, my day was turned inside out. And guess what? I'm still standing. And I even made it here on time tonight with Mark. What happened? You make time. Stuff happens. It was important. It was important to talk to CP24. It was important to talk to City TV. It was important to be on Facebook and in Twitter. It was important to get this into the public eye, and I did. And it took our Prime Minister 27 hours, but eventually he did actually tweet that no community should suffer any kind of things, using all kinds of broad generalities. Yeah, I'm not so excited about it, but whatever. Even Doug Ford said that tweet. Everybody's tweeting. Wonderful. But that's important, because I feel, this is just a digression, I feel that if we allow things like this to happen, yeah, I know there's a 1% chance it's not anti-Semitic, maybe somebody was offended by glass or pavement, and that's why he said, I understand that. That's eminently 1% possible. But if we are quiet when things like this happen, and we just say, shh, don't make too much noise, you know, Jews should be seen, not heard. What happens is, our enemies are emboldened. So I don't believe in that. I believe in being extremely aggressive. The best defense is an offense. I'm an offensive Jew. I even offend myself sometimes. I'm going to go out there. I'm going to go out there and bring my message out there. There should be no difference between the Jewish community and any other community. If a girl's hijab is torn, and that's, by the way, a terrible thing. No, nobody should be persecuted in this country, and nobody should be attacked in this country. It never happened, but that's another story. But if that hijab was torn, there was an outcry. There should have been an outcry. We should be outraged as decent citizens, as Canadians. I just don't understand why that has more importance than the shattering of glass of a synagogue, especially with the historical ominous touchstones, you know, Kristallnacht and so on and so forth. But I digress. Let's get back to our question. So, sanctifying time, not allowing time to control you. You set the schedule. We finish off our prayers. We say, Mikadesh HaShabbat. On Shabbat, we say our prayers. You say it at the Kiddush. God sanctifies Shabbat. Whether you sanctified Shabbat and made Kiddush or didn't, the Shabbat arrives. You can't say, you know what, God, I have a lot to do, so I'll make Kiddush at 11 o'clock tonight. Yeah, that doesn't work. We don't get to sanctify Shabbat. Shabbat is, in the words of the Talmud, Mekad Shabbakayim, but the Shabbat, it just happens. We get to participate in it. We don't get to sanctify it. We don't get to control it. When it comes, however, to the Yom Tov, when it comes to our festivals, we do control it. Maybe not me and you, but maybe yes, me and you. If we were living in Israel and we would see the new moon suddenly reappear, we would have a sacred duty to get to Jerusalem and to stand in front of the ecclesiastical court of Sanhedrin and say, we saw the new moon. And these people were brilliant, and they had all of the wonders and mysteries of astronomy open to them, and they'd say, yeah, where'd you see the new moon? And the person would say, I saw it like about yay high. And they go, really? Which way were the points of the moon? And they say, well, the moon is pointing like this. You say, yeah, the guy's smoking something. Forget it. No good. The moon was, if the moon would reappear now, it'd be about here, and it would be pointing down, so forget about it. Astronomically impossible, you couldn't have seen it. Maybe it was a UFO, maybe you had some marijuana, I don't know, it didn't work. Never happened. Who was engaged in this process? Who was involved in this process? We were. You see, we would have to come along, and we would have to tell the courts when the moon reappeared. Now, guess how long Jewish months are? Take a guess. How long are they? Are they 29 days or are they 30 days?
30.
Neither. Some are 30 and some are 29. Right. Because if you have 12 hours or so, you have to constantly adjust. And sometimes the moon will be visible when it reappears, and sometimes it won't be visible when it reappears. And this is a dynamic thing. How do we make when we say Kiddush, we say Mekadesh Yisrael V'Hazmanim. We don't say God sanctifies the holidays. We say God sanctifies Israel. Who's Israel? This guy comes into a bakery and he says, I'd like to buy a cake. I said, no problem. It's $49. He says, $49 for a cake? He says, well, the cake is $25, but you know, there's another $19 for Israel. It's okay for Israel, fine. Gives him $49. Comes back a few weeks later, he wants to buy some eclairs, gives him a $60 bill. He says, $60? 20 eclairs? He says, it's $30 for the eclairs, it's $30 for Israel. Okay, $30 for Israel. Comes back, he gets a bill for $192. He says, this is insane. I bought bagels and lox. I bought a couple of cakes, $192. Ah, this is unacceptable. He says, for Israel. He says, I don't care. I want to speak to the manager. He says, Israel! Who's Israel? Is Israel the nation? Is Israel the person? Is Israel the individual? It's even a Jewish name. You could have the name Israel. So who is Mekadesh Israel? Who sanctifies Israel? God sanctifies Israel. What do we do with that sanctification? What do we do with that empowerment, with that holiness? You know, the priest, he performs a wedding. He says, with the powers vested in me. I do a lot of weddings. You know what I am at a wedding? I don't like to admit this. I'm just a glorified mashgiach. Look like a kosher supervisor. That's all I am. That's all the rabbi does at the wedding. To make the rabbi feel good, so I can make a blessing. He's just there as a supervisor. To make sure that the important parties, namely the bride and the groom, are doing what they have to do. And that there's witnesses who are appropriate that are witnessing this. And the rabbi just watches. So to make me feel good, they say, okay, make a bracha. Pick up a cup of wine, make a bracha. It's like at home. They give me wine, make a bracha. That's all the rabbi is doing. That we have no power. Nobody gives us any power. We don't have any power. Who has power from the Torah's perspective? You know who has power? Every Jew has power. You have the power to sanctify. You have the power to hallow. You have the power to sublimate. You have the power to transform. You have the power to be able to transcend the vicissitudes of times and its limitations. You have that power because God gave it to you. And because God gave you that power, if you will dedicate yourself, if you will marshal and muster the ability that God gave you, you can do amazing things, including sanctifying time. Because even ordinary Jews who happen to see the moon reborn can go to the courts, and then the ecclesiastic court says, Mekudesh HaChodesh Mekudesh. At a certain point, we don't have a high court anymore. At a certain point, we weren't unified anymore. At a certain point, this wasn't going to work. So at a certain point, we started getting calendar in the mail in September. And we just knew exactly how to work. But that's not the way it's supposed to be. And let's go back to the times of the Talmud and earlier. So the courts would deem when Rosh Chodesh is. You don't live in Israel. Jews have not been living in Israel for a very long time. Very long. Since the end of the first temple era, Jews have not been living in Israel. So if a Jew's not living in Israel, what's his biggest problem? The biggest problem is, unfortunately, there's no Facebook Live. Not only is no Facebook Live, there isn't even a telegraph machine. How are you going to know if the month is 29 days or if it's 30 days? So I know what you're thinking, Mayor. Who cares, right? Well, you're right. You're right. I don't care. Except that I need to know which day to do the holiday on. So how will I know which day to do Pesach on? I have a day. I have this responsibility. I won't know. Because I don't get the message till day 17, 18, maybe 20, maybe 25. So how do I know when the 14th day of the month is if I don't know when the month began? So what did I do? I had no choice. I made a Pesach Seder. I went through a whole emotions. I made all the blessings. I did everything I could because I might have been obligated. And 24 hours went by and I said, you know, I'm not so sure I did it right yesterday. We got to do this all over again. Now, at a certain point, the calendar stops being dynamic and it's set in stone. And that's where the rabbi stepped in. And the rabbi said, if we will go to a one-day holiday, people will forget the most important principle of our Jewish nation. You know what the most important principle is? That we're empowered. That we count. That we're important. That we're in a partnership with God. That God created time. He created us and said, sanctify time. Change time. Yes, you can do it. We wouldn't remember that. How would we? So because in Israel, they knew, and they would be keeping one day. So we said, okay, you continue with one day of Yom Tov. Outside of Israel, in the diaspora, I don't think any Jews were living in Toronto at the time, but it didn't matter. Outside of Israel, and according to Maimonides, even Israel, if there was no Jews living there, what should you do? We're going to keep 2 days of Yom Tov from now on. Now you asked me, when should we stop keeping 2 days of Yom Tov? I'm going to answer you, Mayor. when you stop observing Purim and stop observing Hanukkah. When you get rid of those pesky holidays and you stop gaining weight from eating those latkes that are fried in too much oil and worrying about your menorah. When you stop saying L'chaim and getting dressed up and having a grand old time on Purim, and when you get rid of all that stuff, that's when you can get rid of the second day of Yom Tov too. Because the same rabbis that said we should listen to the Megillah and light a menorah, those same rabbis that said we should drink four cups of wine at the Seder night, those same rabbis, they also said you should keep two days of Yom Tov outside of Israel. And let me tell you something. The rabbis were given power by God. Because the Torah says, on one place, Lo tasur min hadavar, don't veer away from the things they will tell you. And the Torah says, Kichol asher yoruha, everything they say you must listen. So if the rabbis were given that responsibility by God, when we follow the instructions we got from our Sanhedrin, whose instructions ultimately is it? It's ultimately God's instructions. We really are doing what God wanted us to do. So I think outside of Israel, it takes 2 days to get it done. We're way over
anyway,
my time.
Yeah, no, we're over time. I would like to thank Rabbi Kaplan. It was great. It was very inspiring. I would like to say that Rabbi Kaplan is on Facebook. He gives several lectures daily.
We were live today.
This was actually live.
I figured, why should only you benefit?
And like many hundreds of people internationally, watch your broadcast. Like,
this morning I did the call-in show at Chin Radio. I was supposed to do it before this all happened, but we were supposed to talk about Pesach, and instead we had to talk about this anti-Semitism. So there was nobody calling into the show. And it's not like nobody listens. I get feedback. Nobody's calling in. So a lady called in from Trinidad, and Zelda said, I'm so happy you're calling in. She says, I don't know who you are. I'm watching Rabbi Kaplan on Facebook Live.
So
I didn't know I had friends in Trinidad.